A lot of people left. I hope you don't take that personally, Mr. Pisanias.
I don't even look behind me, Your Honor.
Okay.
Good morning, and may it please the court. District court rulings on contempt motions are reviewed under a discretionary standard. That much we know. We don't shrink from that in this case. Here, the district court committed two errors of law, errors of analytics, in making its ruling that sea change was not in contempt. One goes to the colorable differences issue, which I'll address first, and the second goes to the question of infringement, which I'll address second. With regard to the question of colorable differences, the district court, we believe, misread Thiebaud. The court concluded that by removing the updating of what was called the client ID, which is a number that contains a MAC address that identifies a particular set-top box, by removing that client ID from the connection table and moving it outside that table, that was a change in the functionality of that client ID that took this case out of the contempt realm under the colorable differences standard. That finding, we believe, should have been the start of the district court's inquiry instead of the end of it. What the court then needed to do was to determine whether that removal of that client ID from the table was a significant change, whether it left a fair ground of doubt as to the legality of sea change's conduct.
Talk to me just a little about the standard. This is a pretty, there's a pretty high standard, isn't there, to show that there's no colorable difference?
I think to show that there is no colorable difference, you've got to show that you've done something that's a substantial change. And if you're talking about what our burden is on contempt, I think that the standard is the standard, that there is no colorable difference, that there's no fair ground of doubt as to the legality, the propriety of the defendant's conduct.
Well, excuse me. Go ahead.
I thought you were making the case for kind of a legal error here because you said something that I didn't understand, which was an error in the analytics.
I use that as shorthand in terms of the application of the legal standard of Thiebaud to facts in this case, which the district court said were largely undisputed. You see that at page A7 of his ruling.
And you're saying there was a legal error how? In his not considering that there was a substantial difference?
I mean, so this is where I was going, Judge Prost. The removal of the client ID from the table. Remember, the step that's at stake here in Claim 4 is updating a connection table with an address, particularly an upstream physical address. Once that was removed, the question is under Thiebaud, was that removal a substantial change? And what the district court did not consider, in fact, the district court said that it couldn't consider, was the continued presence of another number, of another address called a session ID, which contained the exact same identifier.
Well, are we quibbling here over whether we use the word removed versus moved? Because clearly we're discussing the movement of the client ID, not the removal entirely. Is that what the quibble is?
I would not describe using
the word removed.
Right. I would not describe our quibble as our dispute here as a quibble.
But
to that point, I think that there are two ways to look at this, and I think the district court was obligated to look at this in both fashions. You could look at it as simply saying, well, gee, you've removed the client ID, which was the focus of the trial proof, from the table. That's the end of the story. That's what the district court did in this case. What the district court didn't do is to consider as an insubstantial change overall. I'm getting a little bit of feedback. I'm sorry. I hope it's not bothering the court. What the court did not do is to consider how the continued presence of updating that same table with exactly the same set-top box identification, which just happens to be a component of what is called the session ID, whether that made it a substantial difference or not.
But the district court's difficulty in doing that was in the 2002 trial, the session ID was not raised or referred to as another identifier. Right?
Well, actually, that's not quite correct. Uh-huh. The focus of our proof at the 2002 trial was on the client ID, no question about that. However, we had testimony at the 2002 trial from Mr. Dobby, from the other side, when he said, what's the session? He was asked, what's the session ID? And the answer was, that is just another identifier for the client. That is at page 5164 of the appendix. Yes, Judge Chiron.
Right. I'm sorry. Why is there some reason? This is, I guess, a minor question. Is there some reason that at the first trial, or at the trial, I guess, you identified the client ID and not the MAC address that's inside it as the upstream physical address?
Well, I think if you look at the trial testimony, it was the client ID, and it was in particular the aspect of the client ID that was the MAC address, or that was called, I think the record refers to it also as a set-top ID.
Right. No, it seems to be clear that the first 30 or something digits before you get to the MAC address is something like throat clearing. I mean,
right.
The only real informational content is the MAC
exactly.
address. But you did not, in your presentation of your infringement proof, did not say that the upstream physical address is the MAC address that is found in the client ID. By the way, whether or not you said it, it's also found in the session ID, but you specifically focused on the client ID as a whole and therefore the MAC address only when it appears in the client ID.
Right, but of course, I think that's accurate, Judge Toronto, and if your question is whether you did, the answer is yes. If the answer is why we did, it was simple. We could have chosen either one. The client ID was the terminology that was used by the defendant in this case. We could equally have done session ID. Now, I think another important...
But having made that choice, doesn't that give the public the awareness that if they do something different than that, they are no longer infringing? They've done something different. They have escaped the concerns that you addressed.
Oh, no, I don't think so at all. Certainly not on this record where you have their own witness testifying at trial that the session ID is just another identifier of the client. And I think it's important also, Chief Judge Rader, to take into account the context.
But again, remember the context that I think Judge Toronto was discussing with you. You chose to say client identifier right here.
Right, and let me answer that with regard to the context of the case. Claim 4 in general, this limitation, Claim 4 in particular, was not a significant component of the trial proof at all. We put on trial proof on this issue. The other side barely, if at all, responded on this. Their non-infringement defense was to an entirely different, as the opinion of this court that you authored, Chief Judge Rader, back in 2006 indicated, it had to do with the manager. That permeated all of the claims. You'll remember.
Nevertheless, I mean, your proof really was about the client ID, knowing full well that its principal informational component was the MAC address, but you didn't say it was the MAC address, and you knew presumably full well that principal information component also appeared in this other thing, which you didn't identify. But add in this. There is, I guess, in the red brief 41 to 43, 44 or something, a whole series of quotes which may or may not go to whether you ever said the claims require a particular use as an address, but they unquestionably stressed that your infringement proof about why the client ID satisfied that element, place substantial reliance on how that element was being used. So back to the Chief Judge's question. When you have relied in your infringement proof on an aspect, here the use as an address, that is plainly, I think you concede, is not part of the new piece, the session ID that's still in the connection table or was until yesterday or something, isn't that all by itself enough to be a colorable difference?
No, it's not. And let me be clear on that. The testimony that you're referring to, Judge Toronto, which appears in the red brief, at pages 43 to 44 in particular, quotes our expert, Dr. Schoenfeld, as saying that the client ID is, quote, used by the ITV system to refer to a client set-top box. And what my friend on the other side have done, what my friends on the other side have done is to take that term used, which is to say used to identify, used to refer, which is the two constructs that you'll see repeatedly quoted back. It simply means refers to. It simply means identifies. And
well, it means that the system, when it wants to identify the box as opposed to the session, actually uses that.
Oh no, I don't think that's what the trial proof said at all. And in fact, that goes to the infringement argument, which is that there is not in the plain language of this claim. Remember that there was no construction. Judge Farnan gave an ordinary meaning instruction to the jury.
Right, let me see if I can just clarify what the line along which I'm thinking, and then you can tell me why I'm wrong. Assume for a minute that I agreed with you that the district judge didn't quite make the right inquiry on colorable differences, but that the critical inquiry is one that actually does focus on this use idea, and assume that I also agree that the use idea is not really part of the claim construction. It doesn't belong in the infringement part. But that the judge's findings about use, well supported by these quotes made in the infringement context, in fact establish the colorable differences, because that was part of your infringement proof. And the first part of TiVo focuses not on what the claim requires, but on what you in fact proved in the original trial. And a significant part of that proof simply doesn't apply to the session ID.
Well, I think my answer to you is that what you are seeing in my friend's brief on the other side with regard to their highlighting of the term use is not use by the system. In fact, what you'll see is the function that is performed by an address is identifying the client. Is that is the use that we were talking about. When you look, for example, I think it's at page it may be at page 44 of their brief, or it also this also was an idea that started cropping up in their contempt expert reports. We agree that an address has to identify the client, yes. But does it have to identify the client to the system? No. Does it have to identify the client in a way that it is used as a network address by the system, which is another way that my friends on the other side have put it? No, that's not what the claim requires. And honestly, Judge Toronto, that's not what our trial proofs were. Our trial proofs were not about how it was used.
Don't you have an additional problem here that NCUBE didn't move to put the redesigned product under the injunction order, and instead we have a contempt action by another heiress 7 years later? Isn't that a little out of context with your arguments that this is so evident that the same identifying information was just located to another place?
Well, I'm not sure, first of all, that attempting to put it under the injunction order is required by the law.
I'm not saying it's required, but if this is such an evident, well accepted, known that it's there, and this is not a redesigned product, it was always there, why wouldn't NCUBE have just moved instantly to include the redesigned product in the injunction order?
Well, in hindsight, maybe we should have, but contempt seems like that's the proper way to go.
7 years later?
Well, no. We didn't move 7 years later. Please understand that. This patent was thrown into reexamination by my friends on the other side. And taking this court's heed from its decision, we did not initiate a contempt hearing until the reexamination was complete. And in fact, if anything, Chief Judge Rader, one might ask in a case like this, why bother appealing the contempt? Why not just go on to the infringement stage because you've got this pending declaratory judgment action? And I'll give you two answers to that. One of them is the real world answer. When this case was tried, it was 2002. But because of the re-exams and other delays, judicial retirements in the District of Delaware, we now have 2 years left on our patent, which was a very young patent at the time this case was tried. That's the real-world aspect of it. Analytically, it is because we should not have to go through this whole exercise again all over when the changes are as small, minute, and ultimately functionally and with regard to the claims themselves, insignificant as these changes are.
On the assumption that they can, by flipping a switch, change the system from what it's been the last 4 or 5 years or something, not so it's not, in fact, so the session ID itself doesn't have the MAC address in it. What is the relief you're ultimately seeking for whatever period of contempt you think there was?
I think we're seeking damages.
And if it was as trivially easy as redoing the session ID to put some arbitrary string or some string of characters other than the MAC address in it, why shouldn't the damages during the contempt be zero?
Well,
if only they had known back since, I don't know, 2004 or 2006, they would have done it then. So how could there actually be
I think if you were putting in a string of numbers, if they were randomly generated and they were still an address, then we still have contempt and we still have infringement. But the fact is they didn't do it. We might not well be here if they had taken the session ID out of that table. But the fact is they didn't.
Or change the session ID so it didn't have the MAC address in it and still wasn't used to refer to the client as opposed to the session.
I think if that were the case, they would have some serious design problems, because if they did not have an address, if they did not have a way to identify the set-top box to which the programming is being sent.
No, but I gather that they do. The client ID is just is still in the system. It's
right.
Just not in the connection table.
Well, if they'd taken it out of the connection table, we'd probably have to proceed in an infringement trial. But the fact is they didn't. And the fact is that the damages will be substantial because they didn't and because they've been competing on our technology. I hope I'll have a little time left for rebuttal. Thank you.
Yes, we'll restore let's give Mr. Castanis 3 minutes of rebuttal and give Mr. Bauer an extra 3 if he needs to use it.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court. So the primary question under TiVo, and the TiVo uses this language, the primary question is whether the accused product is so different from the product previously found to infringe that it raises a fair ground of doubt as to the wrongfulness. Judge Stark found there was a fair ground of doubt as to the wrongfulness of this defendant's conduct. This is a contempt motion. All of the argument they're making are findings of fact issues. They haven't challenged on appeal any finding of fact. They haven't alleged any finding of fact is erroneous.
I took it actually that they have an argument on each of the two prongs of TiVo, and both of them are in effect legal arguments, but just focus on the first for a minute. And I take it that their principal argument is that the district court simply never made the correct comparison. He made a comparison between the old system with the client ID in the connection table and the new system with the client ID somewhere else, but he didn't ask, well, what else is still in the connection table, namely the session ID, is that colorably different? And he just didn't ask that question. And he sort of acknowledges that at this stage, he didn't ask that question because his footnote 8 or 10 or whatever it is says, back in 2011, I think I did kind of ask that question, but I no longer think I should. So why are they wrong in saying he didn't even ask the right question for TiVo Part 1?
Well, Your Honor, they're wrong for a couple reasons. One is they say that the standard here was that we had to prove that there was a substantial difference. That's not the standard. Under TiVo, they had to prove that there was an insubstantial difference. Their burden, clear and convincing evidence that these changes were insubstantial. Their burden of proof. Now, two pieces. One, the client ID was taken out. They didn't put any evidence in that the removal of the client ID was an insubstantial change. In fact, they've conceded, and for all except using those exact words, taking the client ID out gets you out from the infringement as alleged. The client ID was removed from the connection table, and there is not a shred of evidence that suggests that removing the client ID was not a substantial change. It took 7,500 hours, it redesigned the system, and it's in an entirely different location. Not one shred of evidence that the removal of the client ID was not substantial. Then they say, well, we're not going to have to look at that. We're going to go look at the session ID. Well, that's exactly what TiVo says you don't look at, the session ID, because that was an unaccused product. That's for a separate infringement case, if they even have the right to make that, because that was an issue should have been raised in the original trial. So just like in the original trial, if they had lost at the original trial on this, they couldn't have sued us again and said, now we're going to go look at the session ID because we think that's a separate infringement. So TiVo says you're not even supposed to look at the session ID for the colorable differences if it wasn't alleged. Judge Stark does look at it. Now, he puts most of that analysis into the infringement section, but he goes through great detail. It was what the whole trial, we had a one-day evidentiary hearing. We had experts. Mr. Davey testified. It went into all the facts about how this works and what the session ID is and how different it is, how significantly different it is. And Judge Stark found that it was significantly different, says we didn't have to do it. He does it in the infringement analysis.
Is the session ID used by the system to refer to the client?
It is not used as an address in the system. It is not, Your Honor.
I think I tried very carefully to ask
to refer
you a different
to the,
question.
It does not refer to the client, Your Honor. It is a unique identifier for the session within the system. So the important thing to remember is the session
and sorry,
ID.
To refer to a session, does one – a session is with a particular client. Does – in referring to a client, do you always refer – I mean, in referring to a session, do you necessarily or ordinarily always refer to the client that's part of the session?
No, Your Honor. The session – so you have – one client can have multiple sessions, for example, right? So if you use your cable – where you're flipping back and forth between channels. You could have different sessions. So the session identifier...
But not the other way.
I'm sorry?
A session is not going to have multiple clients, is it?
A session would not... One session is one...
Even if you're flipping back and forth, it's going to have the same client ID
the same,
and everything.
But that's the client identifier. That's the address for the client. So the client... There's different... Every identifier isn't an address. The claim requires the physical address. And so when they keep talking about Mr. Davey and what he testified, and first of all, Judge Stark was as clear as could be that they are using that out of context. All of that evidence, he says that, that the testimony of Mr. Davey highlighted by Aris does not clearly and convincingly support Aris's infringement theory. When viewed in the proper context, the session ID is an arbitrary 10-digit number. Now, it's made with the MAC address, but it's an arbitrary 10-digit number. It's not an address. So Mr. Davey, in the same testimony, and this isn't cited in the brief, but I'll just refer your honors to it because it's in the same at page A5163. Which is the transcript at page 1165, he was asked, is the session ID an address, very specifically? And he says, are those addresses? No, those are identifiers. What's the difference between an identifier and an address? An identifier, like my identifier is my name or my social security number. It tells you who I am. An address is my street address. It tells you where I'm located. Not every number is an address. The address, and this court talked about it in the 2006 decision, the address is the physical location of the device. It's the physical location. It's the place where the signal is going. The session ID is a random, arbitrary 10-digit number that is in the table that just, because there's 1,000 users plugged into this at the same time at the cable, right? This is the cable head end. And so every time there's a new request, it's session one, it's session two, it's session three. How do you make those sessions unique? Well, the way the industry does, this is an industry standard. It says take your address and add some other number to the back of it. But that becomes a 10-digit number. When they say that the MAC address is in there, it's not in there. It's six bytes of this 10-byte number. But it's... We use the example of the number 1 billion with 10 digits. And the fact that some of those digits happen to look to you as a human observer, but the computer doesn't know.
If session 3 is Judge Toronto and session 4 is Judge Prost, those will have unique identifying numbers that will also identify the clients, right? Judge Toronto and Judge Prost.
No, Your Honor. Those are unique numbers that identify the session. Period. Period. The computer doesn't use the session ID in any way, shape, or form to identify the client. That's the evidence. And now we're getting into clearly erroneous.
Can you ascertain the client's identity from that session
The computer never identifies the client from that session ID. That's the evidence. It is unquestioned evidence. The computer never reverse engineers the session ID to pull out the client identifier.
But it's there.
It is not there to the computer. The computer only sees a 10-byte number. To you as a human, you're great at patent recognition. You might see that number there. The computer doesn't see it. The computer sees a 10-digit number. It doesn't see the client identifier in any way, shape, or form. It doesn't use that number to identify clients in any way, shape, or form.
In what way did or does the system use the client ID as a client identifier?
The client ID is the upstream physical address. That's what was presented to the jury.
Right. Can you explain that in terms I might hope to understand what that means?
So, Your Honor, so what this patent goes to, and it's fairly well described in the 2006 decision, which if I can just I'll get you the exact page where the down around page 1321. Where the court's talking about the upstream manager and this connection table. And what the patent was going to is how can you have all of these different users into the system and match up upstream addresses and downstream addresses. So you as the – and we spent a whole day with Judge Stark, so you're asking me to explain it to you in 20 seconds without my PowerPoint.
Give it your best shot.
Okay. Because we really had all the animation, the signals zipping around. But that's why, by the way, for contempt, question of fact, I mean, clearing, you know, Judge Stark heard all this, heard all the evidence. The upstream user, you at home, have your clicker, and you click on it, it sends a signal to Cox Communications, your cable provider. That signal will include in it the upstream address. It says, Judge Toronto, here is the address of my box. All right. It goes into the connection table. This is the way it did in the infringing. And the connection table had a bunch of identifiers. It had the upstream address, a physical address, and a logical address. The logical address, the way people describe it, your phone number is a logical address because when you dial your phone, the network doesn't really know your phone number. It's sort of a mnemonic. So it goes into the table. You have your logical, upstream logical address, your upstream physical address. You have your downstream logical address, your downstream physical address, because the signal doesn't go back to the same box. It goes to your television. So that's why it's a different address. It says, here I am, my upstream address. It goes into the system. It processes the movie, and now it sends the signal back to the downstream address. All of that's supposed to be in the connection table. That was the whole point of the invention. They're all in the same table. Now, they pointed to the client identification as being in there. We took it out. They didn't challenge that issue. They didn't say taking it out was equivalent or it still works the same or anything. They conceded away that the client ID was removed from the connection table as alleged. The session ID is the thing on the line that says we have a whole line of all of these other things, right? Each one. Here's the downstream address, the upstream address, line two, the next person's upstream, downstream. Line three, the next person's upstream, downstream. That's what the session ID is. It's just each item down the list. And it was made with the MAC address originally. But it's an arbitrary number. And the system doesn't use that as an address ever. And that's why we were able to show the judge, as you asked, where it took us 7,000 hours to design this out originally, 300 hours, if what this is all about, in their view, is just what are those random numbers that are in that session ID, as if there's something offensive. It has nothing to do with the invention. Nothing to do with the invention. The claim doesn't talk about a session ID. It's not an element of the claim. And what happened is, after they moved for contempt in 2009, that 7 years later, and there's something else going on here, as I think Your Honor's right. I mean, NCUBE didn't have a problem with this. They were the ones who had the chance to at least raise it as an issue when the injunction was issued. It's not about the patent was in re-exam. NCUBE that brought this case had no issues that they presented to the court. And 7 years later, they bring the contempt motion, talking about the client ID. They get into discovery. They see the client ID's out. And they go, now they get clever, and they say, you know what? The session ID still has those numbers buried in it. But they got it, and this is all fact-finding. And again, when we get into contempt, Judge Stark found there was a fair grounds of doubt. And what we're talking about is contempt. SeaChange did what it was supposed to do. It took out the accused product.
Do I understand right that you have since at least redesigned the content of the session ID so it no longer has the MAC address in it?
As part of the evidence for the contempt, we wanted to show the court, we were trying to prove that the session ID is not used as a client identifier, all right? Because that was the issue that they were saying, that you really did it twice and that there was two things in there. So we wanted to prove that the session ID was not used and that the MAC address had no relevance to this. So the company redesigned the technology, and you're right, has a product ready to go. What had a product, I can't say now, it's been a year, but had a product just in case that they could go and change. Now, it's not so easy as flip switch because you'd have to go to your customers and change the software. People don't want to do that. It's not necessary. We took out the client ID. It becomes almost semantic at this point that if all you got to do is change the number, so it looks a little more arbitrary. This isn't contempt, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Bauer.
Thank you.
Ms. Thanius, we've restored 3 minutes. The district judge did make a finding that this session ID is not used to identify clients.
That's exactly right, and I think that really does point up where the district judge went off base a little bit. I think
the key is this is a finding. That's pretty hard, a factual finding, isn't it?
And with regard, as far as if we all agree what the term use is means here, what he was talking about in his findings was what he called functionality. It's the argument that Mr. Bauer was making with regard to what the computer sees. Well, where we believe the district court got off base in this case was in thinking that the claim limitation, the last limitation of Claim 4, required focusing on functionality. That's what really skewed the analysis on both the colorable differences as well as the infringement factors. The case law on infringement is clear that language, plain language of that claim limitation, does not require a particular use. It doesn't require the computer to see it. It just
requires the connection service table with said upstream physical address.
Right. All it requires is updating. All it requires is updating. That's the point. And if you look, Chief Judge Rader, at what the parties' proposed claim constructions were, the ones that the judge decided not to give in favor of plain language, you won't see a use limitation, not in theirs, not in ours. You can find those, by the way, theirs at A346. Ours was at A101 and 102. Both constructions use the term identifier. And what we now hear is this argument that an address and an identifier aren't the same thing. That's sophistry. And Mr. Bauer was very careful to answer you, Chief Judge Rader, with regard to the presence of the MAC address, of whether that was an address. And he said the computer doesn't see it that way. But you know what? It is an address. It's called a MAC address, and it's in both the session ID and the client ID. With regard to the claim that these numbers are random, that's not a random number. The programming can't get to Judge Toronto's set-top box without the session ID, and he can't get billed for it without the client ID. That's why it has that same identifier, that same address in there. Finally, with regard to this question about reexamination.
You could have an arbitrary session ID with a correlation table with the actual ID residing elsewhere, couldn't you?
And if that were the case,
the billing?
Yeah, I think you could do that, but I think then we'd have to have a fight, and this would probably have to be in an infringement trial, over whether that random number with a correlation table is in fact an address under the language of the last limitation of Claim 4. Of course, that's not our case here. Finally, one last thing. 6634 is our predecessor, C-Corps' letter to SeaChange, Chief Judge Rader, this goes to your point about the injunction saying to his contemporary on the other side, his counterpart, that there is an open issue with regard to liability with regard to this alleged redesign. That was met within a month by SeaChange throwing this patent into reexamination, and that really just halted things for a while. So I really don't think we should be tasked with any delay in this case. Final comment, what we're asking for here is a remand so that the proper inquiry, Judge Toronto, as you said, the judge didn't make the right comparison. That's exactly what we've asked him to do. And thank you for your time and for the additional time.
Thank you. That concludes our morning.